Okay, today I'm in the George in Lambourne. I hasten to add drinking cups of tea and coffee with Brian Toomey. Thanks very much for agreeing to talk to us today, Brian. Now, I think the accident you had has been pretty well documented recently. You were 33-1 shot to survive. But like horses, you didn't know what price you were at the time. But going back to where you started, you must have been a bigger price to become a jockey in the first place. You come from a farming background in Ireland?
Yeah, a farming background. My family aren't into racing. They're not racing people, but I was lucky enough. I loved horses as a kid, and I was lucky enough that my family sent me for like riding lessons, and then they bought me a pony, and I was able to teach myself going around the farm. I was started from there really.
So what would have been your sort of age when you first did you ever go to the pony club, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I did a bit of that when I'd say I could have been 12 years of age, I think. 12 years of age when my parents bought me my first pony, so I was lucky.
And would you take part in point to points and sort of thing?
Yeah, point to points in Ireland before I came over here, and it was a very good learning curve. I was learning off some of the best horsemen that I've ever dealt with, you know what I mean? It was a very good learning curve. I was learning off good people.
Now, when did you decide to take the plunge and come to England? Where did you start?
Well, it was, my mum is a nurse, and she nursed with Brian Meehan's father. He was a surgeon, and he passed away last year, God rest him, but it was a bit of discussion they were having, and they came up with the plan that it would be a good idea for me to come to Ireland, come to England, sorry. It was good for, it'd be good for a young lad to get opportunities and get going, so I finished school, completed school, and came straight over.
And your career was going very well with about 80 winners, and then in July 2013 you had your accident.
Yeah.
Now, I understand that the BHA sent out a press release saying you'd actually died. Did anybody see that didn't know that you hadn't at the time? Was that something that...
No one's ever admitted to have seen it, but it was so bad in the early stages. I think people were expecting it probably, you know what I mean? It was. I had lost consciousness when I got the fall. I was taken to hospital with a 3% chance of survival, to be honest. People were probably expecting it, but it was very hard for my family. Like my funeral was practically arranged. Like I think my mother had my organs donated. I was written off. I think it was so bad like that. I was written off.
Obviously, you learnt about this in hindsight. I mean, how did your family cope being remote over in Ireland? And how long were you, critical that it could go either way for?
Well, on the day of the injury, I was very lucky. A close friend of mine, Brian Hughes, he actually rang. He was the first person to pick up the phone to speak to my family in Ireland, and I'm sure it was one of the worst phone calls he's ever made to tell him how bad it was. So they had to come straight over, they had to get the first flight over. But I was then put in an induced coma for, I think, 12 or 13 days. So, I mean, I think for the first 2 weeks they probably thought it could go either way.
Okay, then you woke up and found out how lucky you've been and that you got these horrific injuries. You spent 157 days in hospital recovering. There must have been some pretty dark times for you at that point.
Yeah.
Well, during that period.
Well, I was lucky in a way. I don't remember a single thing from being in hospital. And when I did come out of hospital, I was still getting a lot of occupational therapy, and I was in a lot of rehabilitation. But I was on seizure tablets, and they were quite strong. So they kind of have the effect they have on you, I remembered, they just knock you out, kind of, they switch everything off. So, I was unaware of how serious it was until I've looked back and seen press releases of me, apparently I was dead and stuff. It was very hard on my family because I was unaware of what was going on. I mean, they came out quite bad out of it.
Now, before we decided to come to the pub, we met at Oaksey House, which is in Lambourne and helps injured jockeys. I mean, how helpful have they been in your rehabilitation?
It's unbelievable. I mean, we're very, very lucky as jockeys, because our ex-jockeys, I mean, the care that's there for us is incredible. I don't know how jockeys ever did without it, whether it's rehabilitation, whether it's physio, whether it's any kind of even mental illnesses or anything you're going through, they're there for you. They're only a phone call away, and it's the care that's there for us is incredible, and they've been very, very good to me, and I'd be lost without them, to be honest.
Okay, now you come across as being very sort of confident and determined, but there must have been, you know, how do you cope when you sort of lay there at night and you get the why me sort of moments? And does that happen very often, or did you manage to banish it?
No, it did happen very often, and a lot more than I've admitted to people, because I think as a young lad, you've got this little ego. You think it's not, you don't think it is very cool to admit that you're struggling. Like, I struggled, I really, really did struggle, and I kept a lot of it to myself because I didn't want to speak to people about it. I didn't want to tell them like how much it was affecting me, but I was becoming nocturnal nearly. I had more sleepless nights. Like, I was just lying in bed thinking, why me? Like, I felt like my whole life has completely been taken off me. I didn't realize, actually, you know what, I'm very, very lucky. I'm very still very lucky to be here. I didn't realize how lucky I was, but there was a lot of dark days.
And since then, obviously, you've been talking about it to the press. Did opening up to somebody help?
It did and it didn't, because I think after a head and brain injury, they're all so different. No one and every like no one knows exactly how serious it is, or how bad it is affecting you. So, and you feel like you've no one to compare yourself to, because they're so different, like, and everyone I've known that has had head injuries and stuff, mine was very different, so I couldn't connect kind of with people and talk to people about it, but I don't know how I got by keeping it all to myself, because it was very tough.
Do you think it's difficult for people to sort of bring the subject up, or, you know, whether they know whether they should or not, and that sort of thing, you know, socially? Is it difficult for other people, do you think, in the industry?
It is, because people genuinely don't understand how it's affecting you, because to look at, you think, well, you look normal, like, you look okay, like, you don't see the effects it's caused you physically, but because I've always had, like, I've always been, like, kind of positive kind of guy, real good fun, with a good sense, my humour was always kind of very positive, so I don't think people realise how much it was affecting me, because it was all an act, like, to be honest, it was.
Okay, now, I've read that you had to retake the driving test.
Mm.
How many other sort of things did you have to learn to do again? It sounds like a real sort of uphill challenge.
I had to do it. There was a lot of things I had to do again. Obviously, it's a case of nearly prove yourself again after what has happened. But obviously, I had to do the driving test, and I had so much checkups with doctors and everything for the first year and a half. I had so many checkups to go to. It was nearly a daily routine. But then I got back racing 2 years after the injury, so up until then I had fitness tests, I had everything, I had a lot to do.
Right, that's interesting. You were back in the saddle, amazingly, after 2 years after your injury. Most of that first year you spent in hospital, so, you know, 18 months really.
Mm.
Was it a real drive in you to get back to ride, or was it something that you thought, you know, the old adage, get back on the horse as soon as possible? You know, what was your motivation for getting back in the saddle that quickly?
I mean, it was my passion, it was my dream, it was my dream job. I felt like it had been taken off me. I felt like I was very hard done by, so I wasn't going to give up. I was trying my hardest to get back being competitive again, get back and have a future out of being a jockey. I was delighted I did get back, but I mean, it was, it wasn't very it wasn't a very clever thing to do, or it wasn't very kind of me, because my family were just worried about me, and people close to me just really wish I hadn't done it. But I was too independent. I didn't listen to anyone. I put myself first, which I do regret. I have a lot of regrets, because I probably like went against people giving their opinion about me doing it or not doing it. So I mean, I apologize. I couldn't apologize enough, but I wouldn't have taken another heavy fall, so I knew that myself. So I was very stupid to do that.
It seems slightly surprising that, you know, knowing the possible consequences that you were given your license, but really, was that something that surprised you at the time?
Yeah, I didn't. It was the biggest con of all time. I don't know how I got back, because in order to get back being a jockey, you have to be at no greater risk than the next jockey. So I mean, I would have been riding against like top jockeys like Richard Johnson and Noel Feely, and I had to prove that I was at no greater risk than them. But I mean, half my head I have a titanium plate in my head. I'd lost consciousness before. I had such a bad, but I got back and I had 23 rides, but I didn't get back into the winner's enclosure again, but I gave it every go.
Okay, so what was the sort of catalyst where you decided, right, I've made a rick here, I shouldn't have come back, and decided to hang your boots up again?
Well, it was from an idol of mine, actually. I went home for a weekend, and I went up to End of Bulgers, and relations of mine were the McNamara's. I mean, poor John Thomas, God rest him, passed away, and my other cousin Robbie was paralysed from a fall. And then the Bulger pulled me aside and he said, "You don't realise what you're putting your family through." He said, You need to hang your boots up, you can't keep doing this." And I just there and then I swallowed, I took it all in, and I put an end to it. But then a few years later when I went or sorry, a year later when I was in I went home to Ireland for a little while. And I was riding out every day, and I never lost how passionate I was about it. And I reapplied for my license in Ireland, and they turned me down. A neurosurgeon said that I wouldn't face another concussion, so I got turned down after getting back 2 years later. After 2 years after injury, I got passed, but then I was turned down. So it was an end to it. It was definitely put.
Okay, Brian. In the first part, we sort of explained why, you know, you decided to drop the dream of becoming, you know, a jockey again. Did you ever, at that point, did you ever consider turning your back on the racing industry altogether?
No, and I never ever, that never crossed my mind, because even when I was a jockey, I was always buying and selling a few horses. I had a big interest in the training side of things, and training was always going to be my goal. I mean, even before I came to England, I had my own pointer in Ireland. I was training my own pointer from home and stuff. So through trial and error, I'd worked out how I was going to do things. So I was never ever going to turn my back on it.
Okay, you were based in up north when you were a jockey, and now you're in Lambourne. I assume that was because of it was Oaksey House originally that you came back.
It wasn't, to be honest. Because we're looking in the north now, there's Jack Berry House, so there's the centres are there for us. But I went assistant to Dr. Richard Newland, Grand National winner trainer in Worcester, in the Worcester area. And I mean, I learned an awful lot off him. He's an incredible man. He just does things so well. And it was a great learning curve for me. But then when I was doing my trainer's course, my modules for my trainer's course, I came back to Lambourne. I used Lambourne as a base. So I was in a daily routine. I was working in Lambourne, so it was my daily routine.
Okay, so you talk about the module you've got to do for your trainer's course. A lot of people may be surprised that you need to even do a course to be a trainer. You know, you probably sort of learn it off of somebody. What can you give us a little bit of background into what that entails?
Yeah, I mean, you have to, like, there's just like different speakers, and like whether it's staff management, whether it's like nutrition, what, like, just you have to sit through the whole, there's three modules, so there's like say three separate weeks, but it was quite good. And I guess you have to, the BHA have to be assured that that you've now done the modules and you can apply for your license to get your license to train. I mean, it's not everyone that can train professionally. So
okay, so you give yourself every chance. At the moment, I met you just after you've been riding out this morning. I think is it for Clive Cox you ride out. Now you talked about full, you know, potential injuries of a fall before. Now I imagine that you could be a lot more injured than most people if you manage to fall off on the gallops. Are you just incredibly brave, or is the love of what you do banish any fear?
I think other people would class it as a bit silly, but it's a passion, and it is obviously I am a greater risk, but the way I look at it is, even when I sat my driving test a year after the injury, you have a 25% chance of having a car crash, and I'm allowed to drive on the road, so I think I'm willing to take plenty of risks.
And does Clive sort of let you get hands on in the yard as well, sort of learn a bit of the background of training and sort of?
Yeah, I do. I have a very good relationship with Clive, and I go racing with Clive quite a bit, and our sales are. I really look up to him. He's a good man, and I have a lot of respect for him.
Okay, so thinking practically, you want your ambition now is to be a trainer. You've shown that the drive that you've shown in the past, you can do whatever you want to do. What is the first practical goal in attaining that dream to be a trainer at the moment?
Well, I'm working towards that every day, but as I said, I come from a dairy farm in Ireland. I don't come from a racing family, so financially it's going to be near impossible, but I've achieved impossible before by doing what I've done, so I'm not going to give up. But I would, if it was, I just need the support of the racing community. I mean, the racing community have been incredible to me already, and if I was lucky enough to get a little bit of support, like a little bit of backing, then it would get me on my feet.
And we're in Lamble. Is Lamble a very close knit community, with support network as well for you?
It is. I mean, you see a lot of good people in Lamborn. There's some of the world's top trainers are around the Lamborn area. It's a good place. It's a big racing village. But I mean, there's, if you look on the BHA website, there's 600 licensed trainers in the UK, and they're not all just in Lamborn. If you do the job right, you can train from most places. I think it doesn't have to be Lamborn that you train out of, or Newmarket that you train out of. Like, I'd be willing to train out of anywhere.
Okay, but we're talking to you sort of today, I suppose, really because you had the terrible injury which you survived. Now, it is part of the ambition to become a trainer to ensure that the Ryan, the chap that had a terrible injury, isn't what you're remembered for. You want to go, because you're only 30.
Exactly.
You're still quite young, regardless of what you might think.
Sometimes I feel older, but no, it's not. I don't want to be known as the Brian Toomey that had the fall. I want to be known as, obviously, someone that has made a good name for himself as a trainer. To be honest, if I'm trying to leave it all behind me, but I'm lucky enough to survive what I survived, and it was that serious. It's obviously going to come up in conversation quite a bit, but no, I want to be known as Brian Toomey, the person who's made it as a trainer.
One thing that interests me, Brian, people that are involved with riding horses, training horses, jockeys, they've got a passion for it, and it doesn't matter if it's badly paid, the rewards are poor. What is it that is such a magnet for people? It's like a drug. Once they're there, they're hooked. What is it you love about it so much?
Well, it's an incredible job. You're working with a beautiful animal. A horse can't talk to you, so you're all trying to work out what's what. At the end of the day, training horses or riding horses, it's an opinion. Say, for instance, how did a horse go? That's someone's opinion. So in my way of looking at it is, I hope my opinion will be right more times than not. But like, as I say, like, there's a lot of people you'd look up to that do really, really well. I mean, like, I would love to be known as like a good horseman, like a person that's like that cares very well for the horse, that knows the horse, that, that works out what exactly the horse would benefit from, or what the horse, what's like, say for instance, the horse's best distances, or I put a lot of thought and effort into that. But it, as I say, it is addictive, and I mean, it was the one thing, it was the passion that killed me, but it's my passion has brought me back into it, you know what I mean? It is a great job.
Okay, you were a jump jockey, but now you want to specialise in flat when you become a trainer. Why the change of codes?
Well, I did have a few rides on the flat when I was a jockey, but realistically, I mean, there's my goal would be when I get owners is I would like to make it pay for them, like, and I would like, hopefully, like that they can see that it's paying for them a little bit. There's more chance of making better prize money on the flat. I mean, every owner wants to go to Royal Ascot, so I try to sell that dream as well. But it's I think it's I mean, as well, obviously the flat season is in the summer, people want to go racing and they don't want to put on all their overcoats going racing, so I think it's the flat racing is the way forward, I think.
And is the obviously, apart from the jumping side of it, is the mechanics of training a flat horse and jump horse is very, do they differ much?
It is, but realistically is that owners obviously have to be very, very patient, but it's a slower process with a jump horse, because I mean, a jump horse, like, you can't realistically, they don't tend to run as much, like, or they don't, they tend to take longer. I mean, a jump horse, you might own him as a yearling or as a 2-year-old, he mightn't run till he's a 4 or 5-year-old, and it's a slower process. So I would, to keep a good relationship with my owners, I think it would be, I think flat horses would be the way forward.
And do you think, you mentioned breeding before, do you think the breeding aspect would naturally follow on if when you become a successful trainer?
To be honest, no, it's not something that I'm passionate about. I would like to choose different pedigrees that I like, out of many different horses. The breeding side of things has never been an interest.
Okay, Brian, thank you very much. So next stop, hopefully taking out that trainer's license, and anybody watching, they know where to get in touch with you.
Yeah, I mean, I would appreciate any help possible and any support, but I'm trying hard, and I'm not going to run out of my determination. I'm going to stick at it, because it is my main goal. So, like, I would appreciate any support.
Okay, Brian Toomey, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.